Thank you. So actually, there are a couple of different pieces of. Okay. It's actually my first time being recorded. Better be careful. No excuse. So there are actually a couple of different pieces of 1D stuff I would like to let you know, but due to the limitation of time, I guess I should take just maybe 2 or 3 minutes to advertise one piece and spend the rest of the time discussing the other piece. So let me start with the advertisement. This is something we recently finished with my postdoc, Akaki Malakits, who was actually a postdoc here before coming working with me about last September. So the idea of the work is actually very similar to the idea.
AI listening.
Mel
One more syllable.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Good. I hope his name is not wrong on the paper. So the idea of the work is actually.
Sorry.
It's okay. The idea of the work is actually very similar to those explained by Amir in his very nice talk yesterday, except we use the idea in a slightly different setting. So we consider tunneling between quantum Hall edges in the case of extended junction that is uniform, such that the electron momentum is conserved during the process. And the idea, just as Amir explained, is that this would allow you to map out the dispersion relation of the different quantum Hall edge modes. There are two different types of systems that actually realize this. One is those used by Wu and Kang, in which you have a very high barrier that separates the quantum Hall liquid into two regions, and you have edge modes propagating opposite directions on the two sides of the barrier. Another possible system, which has not been done yet, is the bilayer system, where you have two different layers. And of course, you have edge modes in each of the two layers, and you can tunnel between them. And in this case, the two modes are propagating in the same direction.
These are finite bilayers.
Well, I mean, it's extended junction, so actually the size is not an issue here. I mean, if you want to observe the fringe pattern or something, you need a finite size, but for us, that's not important. So, yeah, it's a Hall bar, yeah. Using ideas similar to those Amir explained, you can actually map out the dispersion relation of the edge modes, and in particular, you can actually detect the number of edge modes in the system. The reason that we are interested in this is because we have reasons to believe that at the edge of a fractional quantum Hall liquid, you always have edge reconstruction. And edge reconstruction will give you more modes than those predicted by the Carroll-Lottinger liquid theory. And those modes are responsible for the anomaly or disagreement between theory and experiment, as those, for example, in the edge tunneling experiments by Albert Chan and Matt Grayson. So our results are available on CONMAT. I believe the reference number is 404050002. And that's all what I can say at this point. If you're interested, you can look up the paper and we can also discuss in more detail. So now let me move on to the other topic, which I would actually like to discuss in more detail, partly because I think it's slightly more interesting, but also partly because I have run into referee trouble. So I need some help from the community. So let me actually leave that apart. Yeah. So if the referee is in the audience, I hope I'll do a better job today than writing the paper or than the paper that you actually read. So this is a theory, if you wish, of a ferromagnetic transition. In 1D metals. So You probably remember that perhaps the very first example of quantum phase transition studied theoretically is the ferromagnetic transition in two- and three-dimensional metals that Hertz studied back in the mid-70s. And I even remember the title of the paper is Quantum Critical Phenomena. And I suppose most of us here actually in this field. So the basic idea in Hertz approach is very simple. So you start with some interacting electrons with spin, of course. And by tuning some parameter like the strength of the interaction, you drive the system through a quantum critical point into either ferromagnetic phase or anti-ferromagnetic phase. So the question is, how do you study that phase transition? So you want to have a lambda-like free energy. And you can perform some scaling analysis about it. So what you, what? Sorry. what was the question?
Why do we want it?
Why do we want it? Because it's interesting, right? We're founded to do it. Anyway. So the approach is, well, this is an interacting problem. You introduce some Hubbard-Stratonovich field to decouple the interaction for magnetic transition, of course, you want to decouple it in some magnetic channel. And then you can integrate out of the fermions. That will leave you with an effective action in terms of the order parameter. Well, this is a very complicated functional, but you can do some, let's say, expansion in terms of the powers or the number of gradients of the order parameter. And the resultant theory is called Hertz-Minnith theory. So if you stop at the Gaussian level for the Hertz-Minnith theory, you find that there is a Gaussian critical point where Z, the dynamical exponent, is 3 for the ferromagnetic transition, for the anti-ferromagnetic transition is 2. And you come to the conclusion then that the upper critical dimension above which interaction is irrelevant, actually you don't know how to write down the full interaction anyway, the upper critical dimension is 4 minus z, which would be 1 for the ferromagnetic case. So in 2 and 3 dimensions, then you would conclude that the transition is controlled by a Gaussian fixed point, and there's nothing interesting. Recently, people start to realize that there might be some problems with this approach. The source of the potential problems is in this procedure, where you integrate out the fermions. When you integrate out the fermions, you're integrating out gapless degrees of freedom. And in general, that at least in principle can lead to singularities. And once you have the singularities, the usual power counting procedure that you're familiar from textbooks may not apply. So the theory start to receive some, I would say, rather serious criticisms recently. And perhaps the most serious criticism is that, I guess, out of about 100 or so materials which exhibits this transition, almost none of them is mean field-like. So it doesn't agree with experiments.
And
I heard there are a couple, but I don't remember whether they are anti-ferromagnetic or ferromagnetic. Out of about 50, 70, I'm only talking about heavy fermion compounds. I'm not familiar with attempts in other systems.
Because I mean, almost all the claims I see, are, you know, how it doesn't apply, which is in various situations or various systems.
Yes, 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 sure, yeah. Yeah, anyway, but one, yeah.
Do you mean degenerate fermions here or localized spins?
I'm not considering disorder here. I'm considering
like Heisenberg-like model.
No, no, it's itinerant fermion.
It's itinerant.
Yeah.
Ferromagnetism for one-dimensional itinerant directions.
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about, but here I'm talking about Hertz-Minnith theory, which is for high dimensions.
Which
theory is that? Hertz-Minnith theory.
In one dimension?
No, no, no. Hertz-Minnith theory is for high dimensions.
Just motivation.
Yeah, this is just motivation, by the way. Yeah.
I thought it's Hertz-Minnith Moria.
Moria, then. Are you his friend?
No.
I don't even know him.
There's an I.
Well, it's a Japanese translation anyway, right? It's not. I'm not even going to try. Anyway, so the idea of the work is it possible to get a bosonic order parameter theory for the ferromagnetic transition in metals that does not involve integrated out of fermions? I'll try to convince you that the answer is actually yes, at least in one dimensions. The reason that the answer can be yes in one dimensions is obvious because we can do bosonization. And bosonization is a faithful representation of all the low energy degrees of freedom of one dimensions, so you don't lose any low energy degree of freedom. So that's what I tried to do. Now you might want to ask, this seems to be an obvious idea, why people didn't consider that earlier. It actually puzzles me, but I think part of the reason might have to do with the fact that back in the 62, there was a theorem proved by Lieb and Mattis. They seem to have proved all the theorems in condensed matter, that you never get a ferromagnetic state in 1D. Well, I took that back. At least for actually a wide range of models, including the Hubbard model and just the ordinary K-squared dispersion. But turns out that it's actually pretty easy to get around the Lieb-Mattis theorem. Let's say if you start with the Hubbard model, but add a next nearest neighbor Hawking, you immediately be able to stabilize a ferromagnetic phase, and the transition appears to be continuous, and that's numerical work, I think, 4 or 5 years ago.
Do you mean Baldrige order?
Yeah, well.
Ferromagnetic Baldrige order by dimension?
Yeah, because it's a conserved quantity, so it's possible. The ferromagnetic order parameter is conserved.
Don't apply the
yes, it's conserved. I mean, it's a good quantum number. The magnet.
At zero temperature.
Spin.
Zero temperature.
Yeah. Right. Now, another way, if you want, as a theorist, to stabilize a ferromagnetic phase is just to introduce a spin-dependent interaction. And that actually is relevant for the code atom people because they have those pseudo-spins which represent different species of atoms. And certainly the interaction is indeed spin-dependent. And I actually even have an experimental motivation, but since Amir is not here, I'm not even going to mention that. So let's start from the theories, which is actually pretty simple. Let's start with the paramagnetic phase, which we know how to describe. So in 1D, we have a spin-charge separation, which means you have the Hamiltonian that can be separated into two parts, the charge part, the spin part, which commute with each other. For my purpose, actually, I should point out that there are also a bunch of so-called irrelevant terms, which turn out to be important for me. And I'm going to specify what kind of irrelevant terms are there and I need. So the transition, of course, is a spin transition, so it happens in the spin sector. So let's look at this part first. So in a specific convention, it can be written as the following. X pi squared, there's some velocity scale. Let me call that V of j, pi squared. And then another velocity scale, dx phi squared. So physically, this is the local magnetization, and this is the local spin current. So this velocity measures the energy cost of a spin current fluctuation, and this measures the energy cost of spin magnetization energy cost. So this actually is a spin stiffness. And this is the inverse susceptibility. So now you ask, I'm sitting in this paramagnetic phase. What happens when I approach the ferromagnetic critical point? Now by definition, as you approach the critical point, the susceptibility diverges. And then this term actually is gone at the critical point. And if you further move into the ferromagnetic phase, you expect this coefficient to be negative. That's how it becomes energetically favorable to develop a magnetization. Now, if that does happen, then you can't really describe the system just using this quadratic Hamiltonian anymore, because the system has no ground state. Then what you need to do is to actually get rescued by some of the higher order or so-called irrelevant terms. And what kind of irrelevant terms can you expect? I just write down some of them randomly. So some of them should have higher gradients, and some of them actually represent interactions. So as long as they are allowed by symmetry, in principle they're all there. But at this Luttinger liquid fixed point, these guys are all technically irrelevant, and that's why you throw them away. But out of the ferromagnetic fixed point where this guy is zero, or in particular in the ferromagnetic phase where this guy is negative, these guys become absolutely crucial. Otherwise, the system is not stable. Microscopically, the interaction term comes from the fact that the spectrum of the fermion is never exactly linear. As Duncan pointed out in his 81 paper, that gives rise to interactions. And this actually has a simpler origin. It just says that the interaction is actually momentum dependent. You have higher momentum gradients. Now, it may not look so familiar, but if I write in terms of the order parameter, which is the magnetization, this is nothing but dm squared, and this is nothing but m to the fourth. And these are exactly the type of terms that you keep in the usual lambda theory. On the other hand,
that's MZ.
That's MZ, yeah. Thank you. That's important. I wish I could replace this by M. I will do that at some point. Yeah, exactly. So these are precisely the type of terms that you keep in the usual lambda theory. But of course, we are studying a quantum phase transition here, and the quantum nature of the transition, the quantum dynamics is actually controlled by this guy. So then I hope people will agree with me that I need these terms for proper description of the ferromagnetic phase and the critical point. And turns out that for reasons that will become clear later, the higher order terms are not going to be important for me. So that's the theory. And to properly analyze the theory, it's better to actually switch from a Hamiltonian to a Lagrangian, which theorists do all the time. So the Lagrangian therefore looks like something like this, but action goes as dx d tau. So the dynamical term would be a derivative term in terms of the field, the spin field. So this guy will be tuned through zero at the transition, and then I have these guys. So that's the action. So let's look at go back to the paramagnetic phase first. For the paramagnetic phase, this guy is positive. These guys are irrelevant. You find that tau and x are symmetric, so z is 1. So that's a property of the Luttinger liquid fixed point. But at the Gaussian fixed point where the transition actually occurs, r is 0. So when r is 0, this guy is gone. You find that tau and x become very asymmetric. It's first a derivative in tau, and second a derivative in x. So at the Gaussian fixed point that describes the transition, z is actually 2.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Well, why you don't have this so all the phi's end of the series are derivative, would the symmetry prevent?
Right, so here, remember, the physical origin of the phi is you count the number of spins to your left. So a constant shift in phi does not change the physics. So the only thing that can matter is derivative in x. And actually, if you had a phi squared term, you would open up a gap for the spin, yeah, which we know does not happen. So then you need to ask, so at the Luttinger liquid fixed point, z is 1, and all of these guys are irrelevant, and you end up with a Gaussian theory. But at the ferromagnetic critical point, or the mean field ferromagnetic critical point, Z turns out to be 2. And you need to redo all the power counting of all your interaction terms. And as you would have guessed, you find that the upper critical dimension is again 4 minus Z, which is 2. But now 2 is bigger than 1, because we are in one dimension. So at this Gaussian fixed point, we find that interaction, like this one, is actually relevant, which is the opposite of the Kurtz-Millis case, where we have Z being equal to 3, the upper critical dimension being 1, but we are above one dimension. So here we have a non-trivial fixed point. Yes.
Just split the
Fermi surface. Yeah. So we have a non-trivial fixed point controlling the Ising transition in 1D, which is different from both, both the Hertz-Millis case in high D and also different from the usual Luttinger liquid situation where Z is 1 and you have a Gaussian theory. So of course, as usual, this fixed point can be accessed through epsilon expansion, which have done the order epsilon calculation.
In higher dimensions, you get a continuous transition to Ising.
Yeah, actually for the Hertz-Millis, it does not even distinguish between Ising and Heisenberg. Everything is just Gaussian. Just like the five-fold theory, whether it's O3 or O1, it's the same thing. Yeah. But here, I have not even worked out the Heisenberg case yet. I mean, I'm actually asking for help, here. But that's what I have done. So I've done all the epsilon calculation, and later Suvia gave me the results of epsilon squared. But that's a very standard exercise. So let me actually just summarize.
It's not some calculation that was already done in the context of uniaxial, dipolar.
No, not to my knowledge. No. But this theory, I mean, you and Ludwig got the same theory in 2D. In 2D, I guess it's marginally irrelevant, so you don't even need to do that. What I'm saying is that you guys get the same theory for the RVB case in 2D, right?
Yeah.
So did you guys look into the literature to see if previous people have done epsilon expansion?
Something about literature. So this kind of model was considered in 1972 by Dzerzhinsky and Martin.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, except they considered in Chair channel rather than spin channel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they just had this case when compressibility changes size.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You
would have got the same thing. Yes. I agree. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
They didn't study critical exponent. They didn't care about critical exponents. But mean field transition.
The mean field transition. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
There are also
yeah.
various old RG calculations in the early days of phase transitions on the dipolar system with various things where you have k squared for some directions and
mm-hmm.
over k for other directions. Things like this.
Maybe you should educate me more about that. Because I didn't know about that. Yeah. Okay. So what you expect then is the following situation, which is standard for quantum phase transitions, because the transition happens only at t equal to 0. So you have some coupling, and we call that R using that notation. So I have some critical point. So here I have a one-dimensional ferromagnet, or more specifically an Ising ferromagnet. And then I also have the Luttinger liquid. And this is the critical point. So at finite t, you don't have a transition, but you do have crossover. So here you would expect classical ferromagnetic behavior. Then you have the usual Luttinger liquid behavior at finite t. But here you have the quantum critical behavior. So let me just write down the results from epsilon expansion in this region. So I found that to order epsilon, this is t 1 minus epsilon over 2. And chi goes as 1 over epsilon t. Well, the point is that you can access the non-trivial behavior at this interacting fixed point through epsilon expansion, and you might think about other things to do as well.
When it diverges like one of epsilon, so what do you mean?
Chi diverges at low temperature. Yeah, Yeah, so let's say if you approach, you go in this way.
That's yeah. the Ising susceptibility.
That's the Ising susceptibility.
XY susceptibility? Looks like 5 with that
lot. The transverse excitation is gapped, right? Hold on.
XY components.
Oh, okay. I haven't looked at that. Yeah, so that would actually require a calculation of the of chi plus minus. Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like, yeah.
Yeah.
Seems like you have a lot of XY fluctuations.
Right. Anyway, so let me actually just close by making a comment on the caveat, which actually has been raised already, which is here I'm using abelian bosonization, which does not respect the O3 rotation symmetry if it is present. So the results therefore only apply to the Ising inversality class, which is the case where the interaction has some Ising anisotropy in it.
Green's function look like?
I have not calculated that. Peter Copias claims that he is doing that. Yeah. So I expect non-Luttinger liquid behavior near the critical point because it's not Gaussian, it's not z equal to 1. I mean, in principle, all the things that you care to calculate can be calculated because I have not lost any degree of freedom. That's very different from the Hertzsprung case.
Perhaps rather than a power law density of states, you'd have some essential singularity.
That's entirely possible.
Faster.
Absolutely. That's entirely possible. So tunneling can detect that too. Yeah. In principle. Okay. That's it. Thanks. That's also on the kind of map. What?
You got to say something. You got interrupted.
What was that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, this is something. Then you got interrupted.
Oh, okay. So what I was saying was that this applies only to the Ising inversality class. It does not apply to the O3 or Heisenberg inversality class. Well, there's no reason to expect that the rotation symmetry is still preserved, right?
These terms also they break the rotation symmetry. Dx, I mean dx pi is a z component.
Maybe your transition coming out of the way can have Ising, the main walls get soft.
Right.
Then you get some kind of bound, you get bound states of the electrons in the main walls. It's interesting stuff like that.
Probably, yeah.
Tuning this V coefficient is like tuning part of the sort of marginally irrelevant.
Right.
J right dot J left operator,
right,
which is the one that's allowed with SU2 invariance. So
mm-hmm.
putting it to zero is sort of pushing yourself far out along this ray, but only in one direction.
Right.
An SU2 invariant critical point would have to be actually out on this ray somewhere. I don't quite remember, but I seem to recall Sabir and Senthil having a paper on this.
Yeah.
I don't think there's actually any conclusion.
Right, right. So they looked at rotor models and got a theory just like this, except that this is a complex field instead of a real field.
Yeah. Another question I have is whether the ferromagnetic, I mean, this anisotropic theory, you're doing some epsilon expansion,
right.
doing some huge variety of ways, I mean.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you can ask about this model directly in two dimensions. Is there a...
That's what you guys did, right? I mean, it's the interaction is marginally irrelevant.
No,
right?
No, sorry. I mean 1 plus 1.
Oh, okay.
Where so it's fully non-Gaussian, but
sure.
Is there a an exact solution for it? And, you know, sums equals there are critical points in 1 plus 1.
Right.
X equals
2. Now, okay. Turns out I didn't say that, but z is actually not exactly 2. Turns out this was what Sophia pointed out to me. Z is actually 2 minus 8/2. But I didn't realize that because eta is 0 to order epsilon. But once eta develops a, once you have an anomalous dimension, z actually gets modified as well.
But is that true to all orders?
Yes. That's what Sophia pointed out to me. That's an exact relation.
In which theory? In the fixed point in this theory?
Right. In the interaction fixed point, yeah.
You're asking about the place where the stiffness is 0 and just if you're Del phi to the fourth term, is that what you're asking about?
Or yeah. Or yeah. Can r equal to 0, is there a, you know, can we find that critical point exactly?
some. Well, then you probably just do the del phi to the fourth too, just have the del squared phi squared. I know.
No. There's some non-Gaussian theory out there, right? Maybe there's some other variables for it. You know, that's the.
In one dimension, is this relevant? Dx phi to the fourth.
Right, that's so, what I said. So you're saying there's a non-trivial point. How do we know there's a non-trivial point out there?
How do you know? Are you doing some epsilon expansion? Can we? Is there some, you know, exact thing that one can do?
I don't think I mean, nothing is even known about pure del squared phi squared points in 1 plus 1 that people worry about, because it should be some kind of weird conformal field theory, but it's nobody, as far as I know, knows anything even about that Gaussian fixed point from the conformal field theory point of view. Like, obviously, you can solve it as a Gaussian.
Okay, it's Gaussian.
Yeah. No, but it doesn't.
You got everything about that.
Why
not?
Yeah,
we're not asking for a conformal fixed
coordinate.
It's presumably not.
Z is not 1 here, right? Okay, well, that's it.
So,
if we just go and show out.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, I'm going to talk about some of the things I've been thinking about, and actually some of the work I've been done with some of this talented postdoc here. And it is, again, about, okay, let me say, about 1D. The general theme is that can we judge the book by its cover? So I know this is against one of the old English saying. Can you judge the book by its cover? Oh, not.
How about by its author?
Which book are you talking about?
Many books. Book.
Big book.
The book physics, actually. Excellent. I haven't talked about physics. I already got questions.
Well, we said something, right?
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah. So the general idea I had in mind is that suppose now I have a correlated book with some physics inside. And the idea is that if somehow I clip this, either the surface or the edge, depends on the dimension of the bulk, can we really tell there going to be some surface or edge excitations? And the question then is that first, can you directly, by probing this surface or edge excitation, and sort of get a very clear interpretation about what is going on inside the book. So that's what I mean, that whether you can judge the book by its cover or not. Yeah. And
another surface a little bit below that one, separating the surface region from the book.
Well, okay. So I will give a specific example that. Yeah. So one of the, I mean, most famous example of this is actually in fractional quantum Hall effect. So in the book, we know the wave function as a Laplace wave function with specific exponents and very complicated wave functions. And if you want to directly probe this wave function, it's going to be difficult. And the simplest way is just put the whole thing on Hall bar and you measure the Hall conductance and you find that it's quantized. So you can actually directly extract the exponents from very simple transport measurements. And the question.
It's a special case because the bulk is trivial. I mean, it's, has nothing discernible.
And if the surface is reconstructed, it can have quite different.
Very good comments. And
issue about the second
thing. Yes. So I would like to add one more thing is that actually, as Xiaogang pointed out quite a long time ago, is that if you try to write down the effective field theory for the bulk with the open boundary, it's actually not gauge invariant. So the gauge invariance, which is required as a or physical measurement, actually tells you that you got to have some astral age degree of freedom, which makes the whole theory gauge invariant. So, I mean, there are many ways to realize the edge states, but I think this is one of the very important criterion that in order to get a gauge invariant series, this edge state exists. Now we can ask the same thing. Do we have similar physics in other correlated system or not? That we can sort of just read off the physics from the edge. And I think there are many examples here. Yeah, due to the short time, I'm going to work on a specific example, which I work with Gil. I hope I spell his name correctly. And Masaki Oshikawa.
Help to write your name as well. It's not very familiar. Will you write your name also, just for compliments?
Oh. My name is Joe Howland. Yeah. So we are working on this idea that if I have a carbon nanotube, and if I cut it correctly, can we make a magnetic STM chip out of this or not? So let me just give you the physics we found is that we found that the electron-electron interaction, which give rise to the bulk physics, that you actually have anti-ferromagnetic correlations, reflects on the edge in a very interesting way that it becomes ferromagnetic. So the short answer to this is yes. If you cut the carbon nanotube correctly, without any impurity and any other, defects, you can actually directly use that as a magnetic tip because it has magnetic moment. And you may ask that this sounds so crazy. I'm taking carbon atoms, which is known to be non-magnetic. Why does a non-magnetic atoms give you magnetic moments? Well, there are many examples, so let me give you some. So the most recent one you can find is actually in science. So this is a carbon foam, or carbon nano foam. The people have been basically doing some fun physics with carbons, and this is one of the pictures if you guys want to circulate around. What you do is that you found that this nano carbon foam actually stick on magnetic materials. So it is ferromagnetic.
And there is no magnetic impurity there. They're 100% sure about that.
Okay, I'm not going to guarantee that.
Making these nanotubes.
Yes. 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 But they have tried their best. Yeah. They say that it's less than 20% of the ferromagnetic orders they observe. And they have been working on this for 4 years. So there are other evidences too. But
calcium hexaborate, where people work on for a very long time.
I will show you another paper which actually show you another thing. Okay.
Could you say one word? What is
nanofoam? Okay. No. Okay. They try to make carbon nanotube, but instead of giving tube, they get something like a bubble. And it's not totally clear what is the detail. What is the detail confirmation of that? But it looks like it's some sort of a incomplete tube. That you try to make tube, but somehow the tube does not complete.
Sounds like incomplete tube with iron impurities in there.
Okay. I'm not going to argue about that. Yeah, since I'm not an experimentalist. Yeah. There are other crazy things, which is if you prepare buckyballs in polymer foam and you measure the magnetization, you also find it turned magnetic. Okay, and you can find relevant. Okay, all these are going to be subject to one critics that Dasama just raised, that is it going to be just trivial magnetic impurity or not? But
this is the exotic workshop, so we're supposed to ignore the
I withdraw my very strong position. Assume there is a magnetic impedance.
The one real problem is published in Nature. That's the one.
Well, the reason I'm pointing out all these references is that I want you guys to read the article. I'm not going to make any guarantee that they are absolutely right.
Even in PRL, there's a different story, but science and Nature.
Okay, I can give you some example. So these are the exotic ones which eventually make their way to science and nature, and they are also hardworking peoples, which actually just there have been a very long puzzle that if you just take natural graphite or any other graphite, you measure the magnetic hysteresis curve for it, you found the hysteresis exists. That is, it has very weak ferromagnetism. And this has been long to be expected that, oh, okay, carbon is so chemically active, so it might absorb some magnetic impurities. But in 2002, there's a PRB paper, okay? So it's not even in PRL.
This has to be right.
This has to be right, yes. And it's from Germany group. It got to be right, right? So they do it really carefully. And if you are interested, I really encourage you to look it up. What they found is that they measured over 25 samples of graphites, and this is what they see. Okay, I'm actually not exaggerating.
What temperature
was the measurement? Room temperature. Yeah. So there are two peculiar features. One, you got this finite hysteresis, which seems to hang there. Okay, it's weak. In the sense that you can see, it's very permanent. But it persists even at room temperature. And it does get a slightly more robust when you lower the temperature. So something must be going on there.
So why can't it be itinerant? Why can't it be itinerant? Right? Graphite conducts, I mean,
true.
The only metal we know doing ferromagnetic.
There are three possible explanations on the market so far. One is the trivial one, that there are some magnetic impurity in the systems. Okay? And they said that they have carefully ruled that out. And there are two competing theories right now. One is just your idea is that it could due to that for the graphite network is so-called the gapless semiconductors. So they can actually, I mean, due to the current interaction, they can form this so-called spin triplet acetone physics. And this acetone condensate would actually give you very weak ferromagnetism. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that in graphites, you've got lots of topological ground boundaries and domain walls. And this domain wall actually carries ferromagnetic. Actually, how?
Can we go to the theory?
Yeah, let's get to the theory.
That's you convinced us that all real ferromagnetism. So let's go on to the
field. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This last piece of things that people actually also see this ferromagnetism in carbon fiber too. So to just end it, it's a PRL. So you can see I intentionally choose all different. There are more than these four papers. I'm just choosing each one to advertise this.
The Nature paper says magnetism lasts for a few hours.
A few hours.
Okay. So as I said, there are several theories competing for the possible explanations. I'm going to just focus on one.
Let him state his case.
So in order to start with, I'm going to basically introduce first a very simple case, which you will see later that why this is relevant. So let me study a semi-infinite graphite sheet with ZZH, okay? Two-dimensional sheet, single sheet.
Isn't this a one-dimensional discussion?
Yes, because I'm going to talk about one-dimensional things immediately. The edge is one-dimensional. So let me, for educational purpose, that take U equals to zero first, okay? The on-site interactions. So I'm only consider a very simple tie binding network with a semi-infinite ZZ interface like that, okay? So, I mean, what can we learn from this? Not much, right? We know
some.
Hmm?
You've got the zero mode edge states, of course.
Exactly, yeah. So you can locate where the zero modes are.
Yeah, like in silicon, right? Yeah. Then bonds like in silicon.
Yeah, but this is a...
Well, it's not... Well, okay.
This is Gauss.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not exactly the same. Yeah, there are two sort of edge states you need to distinguish from. One is the so-called extrinsic, that you got impurity attached to it, or the surface reconstruction. Another one is that you assume nothing happens when you create the edge. Mm-hmm. And then there are some intrinsic edge state associated with the topology just for the edge too. And yeah, and they're actually different, because one is more fragile. You can change that by just very simple manipulations. The other is robust. Yeah, well, at least theoretically. So the idea is that you can actually just do partial Fourier transform in this direction. You end up with a very simple T1, T2 model. And T1 is 2T cosine KX A over 2, and T2 is T. So we know that for T1 not equal to T2, you always get a gap semiconductors. For T1 equal to T2, then you get a gapless mode. This is the nodal point. So if you plot it out, this is what you get. So this both stays.
What are the
x's? Yeah.
Simple
question. You have to rub some of your x's up so you don't hide the entrance.
And which way is x on the figure, x-axis?
OK. So I'm skipping lots of detail here. But if you do it carefully, you will find that Duncan just pointing out that you got some edge states. But the funny thing is, the edge state does not live on the whole Brillouin zone. The edge state actually live at specific moment and space.
Join the direct points.
Exactly. And that has some deeper reason for that, is that you can actually apply Oshikawa's gauge theories, couple this to fictitious gauge. And you end up that this phase diagram, always this funny feature is that if you start with some type A edge state, it always ends at the nodal point or the direct point. And you can either start with another kind of edge state or no edge states and things like that. And there are more complicated examples for this that you do see this pattern realized by explicit calculation.
What is shaded area? What does it mean shaded?
Oh, these are just mean that there are many states here.
Many surface states?
No, the bulk states. The bulk states.
So shaded area is energies of bulk states.
Yes. You can compare this with the infinite sheet. You find it on top of each other, except this little red line I plot. Yeah. I project the two-dimensional Brillouin wind zone into one dimension because I want to fit in this talk here.
And did you make a statement about edge states?
Yeah.
Yeah, and these states, if you...
These 2 points are edge states.
No, these are not 2 points, they're two segments.
Oh, segments, there are segments.
Yeah. This is a pi and 2 pi over 3, yeah.
So there are kind of mini bands of some sort.
Yeah,
mini flat band, yes. And how do you understand this? Well, okay, there's a trivial way that you can understand this in an extreme limit that when T1 is much, much less than T2. So you sort of pair everything up. So if T1 is much, much less than T2, the electrons will pretty much just occupy these dimers, right? And these dimers give you plus minus T2. Mm. What? Just these twos. And then you left with one.
What's T1 and T2 again?
T1 is T cosine KX over 8. T2 is T.
What does it mean? Where does it come from?
No, it's a type binding model.
It's a type binding model. You just Fourier transform.
Plane wave states, right. One direction.
Yeah, you just apply Fourier transform in one direction. It squeezes into effective one-dimensional system. And if you don't like this, you can solve this in two-dimension too. Yeah, I'm just trying to make it simple, but apparently not quite successful. Yeah, and so the easier way to understand this edge spin, the edge mode, is actually just taking this T1 much, much less than T2 limits. So you get these dimers, which basically tells you they are gapped. And the only gapless mode you end up with is this edge mode. But don't forget, this edge mode is after Fourier transform. So if you inverse Fourier transform, you back it corresponding to lots of running modes on the edge. So, okay, that's why
actually,
I'm here.
Running,
yes, they are not running. I'm sorry. Yeah, because their velocity is zero. They are not chiral. They are artificially made lambda levels by cutting the edge.
They actually turn into the edge mode when you do this
quantum
hole like deformation of this graphite.
Mm-hmm. So it's pretty.
What is the size of the sub gap between the very small? Just when compare with
this gap, it's order T. Yeah. So okay, but this simple exam, well, this simple limit actually will help you to understand why you get edge modes. But the edge mode actually have funny features too. Suppose now I plot the wave function along this direction, which I call y. Okay. And the wave function actually looks like this. So the extreme limit is that when you take this decaying exponent to be infinite, so you end up with just 1, 0, and all other at 0. But if you let t1 less than t2, but not very, very small than that, you actually found this very, very funny so-called nodal structures. Yeah, and it is related to some of the underlying physics, which
so
I...
the wave function vanishes at certain sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
On that picture, hexagonal picture, can you indicate size where the
yes.
Vanishes?
Yeah, so if I plot the wave function, it would look like this. Just one sublevel.
Okay, so
and there's no, absolutely no weights here. And it's protected by some, well, it's actually protected by a very simple thing, is that this H state, when you formulate this in the so-called Soucy formalism, they're corresponding to the state annihilated by the supercharge. So that feature is actually robust even when you add in interaction. I'm sorry if I need to talk about such exotic terms. But although I'm solving for u equals 0 limit, but if you turn on u, which is as large as t or just 4 times than t, you also find this wave function here still have these nodal structures. So it's actually, the physics here is very robust. Even though this is very simple calculation, this is actually tell you quite some, well, lots of interesting feature there. Okay, I guess I've, yeah. I better wrap up soon.
Some finite electron form interaction which you'd have, you're talking about a real lattice, wouldn't it dimerize?
Yes. Yeah.
That change what you're talking about? And what will that change what you're talking about?
Well,
will change then, right?
Yes, that's true. But well, this
age is infinite similar electron form interaction.
True, but you can introduce the phonon electron phonon interaction, and people have done that. Yeah, the age mode still live there happily.
But what you tell us later would not change qualitatively because of that.
No. Yeah, and the physics is actually quite simple. You just assume there is no electron phonon interaction and add it in as perturbation. It only lives on edge. So all the electron phonon interaction and dimerization is happening in the bulk, which have minimum damage to the state and has been demonstrated by numerics and by some RG calculation too. Okay, I'd better wrap up. Yeah. So, yeah, let me just make the long story short is that, so Gil and I has been working on this. So if now you wrap this up into carbon nanotube, that represents that you're only cutting through finite points of these H states. And I guess I was give all details. What we found is that, well, obviously, when you cut through this Brillouin zone, you can project out this gap bulk, and you end up with just a finite cluster physics, which can be solved either by hand or by computer. And we have worked this out up to L equal to 10, that 10 unit cell. And what you found is this interesting phenomena that the ground state, the spin living on edge, is 1/2. Times the age filling factor, which I don't even have a time to explain, but anyway, like this. This basically tells you that if you hold a carbon nanotube, which has natural filling nu equal to 1, also corresponding nu e equal to 1, you can now try to tunnel in a little bit electrons. And since this age state has different normalization than in the state in the bulk, So you can actually change the edge filling without changing the bulk fillings. And by doing that, you can actually change the ground state magnetic moment. And you can calculate, this is when you calculate it, you just identify each ground state is at different edge fillings. And this is what you got. So you can maximize fully polarized ground state. So if you really hold a carbon nanotube on a substrate, you can actually, by changing the gauge potential between them and try to deplete, add in or suppress some electron densities, and you get this very funny voltage controlled moment stick on the carbon nanotube. And so I think this would make a very nice application for the magnetic STM, because this whole thing is intrinsic in the sense that it is built in the carbon network. You don't need to do this kind of coding, magnetic coding, like most of like the SP STM nowadays, is that you take a SP STM tip and then coding some magnetic layers. I think I'd better stop here. But I guess the general general idea I try to get out is, again, the same thing, is that whether we can really just read off the bulk physics from the surface of the edge. And this can actually also apply to some other cases, like if you have a superconducting thing, if you cut it off, sometimes you get a undrew edge state out, depends on the topology. And for the bipartite lattice, you can work out straightforwardly. But for some other lattice, like triangle lattice, you actually get very rich physics inside. And if you perform STM things, you can actually get lots of interesting quasi-particle scattering patterns and specific momenta, which can be calculated simply. So I think I will end here. Thanks.
Why do they want to fill ferromagnetic?
Okay, good questions. I would like to note about that too. Oshikawa has a very beautiful argument I don't have time to go through, is that there are tricky ways that you can... Okay, there's a Lipp theorem again. Apparently, Lipp proved all the theorems. Yeah, in 1989.
Excuse me, before we go on the Lipp theorem, situation is simple, right? You fill the states, we spin up and spin down, right?
Yes.
And on this list, we have states, right? And the question is, would they like all spin line up parallel, right? Or feel kind of up down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the question we're discussing.
Yes.
Okay, so let's tell now how Lipp theorem.
There are competitions. So the ferromagnetic ground state does not win over without any competition. It actually worked quite hard to beat other things, RBB states.
Hubbard model, Dr. Hubbard, you need injection, I suppose.
I can work on V2, but yeah. I can include V2. It's not going to change the ferromagnetic ground state.
Same side, neighboring sides, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You can add in more complicated potential profile. That can be done.
Okay.
And it has been done in simpler case. I said limit to L equal to 10. Yeah. So let's go to, can I go on?
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, the Lipp theorem tells you the very nice thing is that Hubbard model in arbitrary dimension on a bipartite lattice at half fillings with on-site interaction U positive. Okay, so there are many criterions. Once these are fulfilled, the answer is very celebrating. The ground state is unique. And the ground state spin is it's the number of side A and side B. Okay. Then you might ask, for honeycomb, NA and NB are the same, right? So there should be, the ground state shouldn't have any ferromagnetic things. So Lipp must do something wrong. Well, they didn't think anything wrong, because Lipp said it's a Hubbard model in arbitrary dimension, but with finite size, which means it's a cluster theorem. Yeah, you cannot take thermodynamic limits. So the tricky part of this things we got out is actually a slight extension of the theorem, is that when NA and NB goes to infinity, and you know that when two things diverge, and you are interested in the difference between them, sometimes they do have anomaly, sometimes they do not. And for this zigzag case, you can get it out. You do get some finite anomalies, and that's what we calculated. And you can actually, by taking thermodynamic limit in a tricky way, you can get this out by Lipp theorem too. And that's due to our smart Oshikawa that he sort of wrote it.
Why is it
M
infinite?
It's infinite. It's a semi-infinite carbon nanotube.
It's an L equal to 10.
So,
L equal 10. That means infinite in the triangle.
I'm sorry, this is LX. This is not LY.
Wait a second. I think it has an H, and your H has only 10 sides, right?
Yes. The bulk is infinite. The bulk is infinite.
So this magnetic tip has to be infinitely long.
Wait a second.
Not really. Second. You can.
For any finite, this theorem.
Very good question. As long as this. No, the only point you try to sell out is that whether there is a sharp distinction between bulk state and H state. And you can calculate how are the localization lengths of this H state. They are usually very short. It's only 1 to 2, lattice constant. So you don't need to be very long. The ordinary commercialized couple narrative is good enough. Yeah, it's actually too good.
On the edge
mode, so it's on the edge. So that's the whole setting point.
Why should you care about some other side of the 2 10 kilometers away?
Well, because the physics grows together. The theorem was proved in the whole cluster. The whole thing is connected. So the beautiful part of this is that the whole physics is connected, but the interesting thing is only happens on the edge. But the existence of H state is certainly supported by this underlying topology of the lattice, which I don't have time to explain. Yeah, so you cannot just saying that, oh, okay, you got H state here, why don't we take off the rest of this? Well, it's not going to work, because H is defined as the boundary of the bulk, so you need bulk to have H.
So to make it too longer, how large is the gap between the ground state with that value of S and the exciting state with the smaller value of S?
That's the greatest worry that Joe just pointed out, is that if you really take the tube to infinite, you are actually facing the competitions for this nodal particle too. But there's a very tricky way to apply the Lie theorem and take the limits. So the ground state is still ferromagnetic. But whether the gap really asymptotic goes to zero or not, we do not know at this point, but it seems so. Yeah. But at any finite length, like the 10-10, the 10-0 Zzag tube, the gap is reasonably large. So you do get a very robust ferromagnetism out. And so I guess your worry is that, suppose now I'm interested in, I take the graphite and I have a domain where I want to study the ferromagnetic fluctuation and dynamics on the edge. Yeah, how does the nodal particle actually couple to the edge mode? That we don't know at this point, and that I think that's actually very interesting. Because this edge mode has already been observed experimentally in graphite sheets. So it's there. But whether it's ferromagnetic or not, it's not clear.
H
states. Just take graphite, peel it off with a 3M tab, and put it on STM. The cheap narrow technology experiment. You identify a very sharp spike of local density of state, just associated with the Zzag age, not for the armature.
Zero energy. Spike at zero energy.
Yes.
That means minimum state.
Yes.
Okay, so that's
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry for taking such a long time.
Well, I hope everyone has enough stamina for this. My talk will be fairly in line with what other people have been discussing so far. Originally, I was going to talk a little bit about our work on Amir Jacobi's experiments in the localized regime, but since he has left, and also since I think it'll fit in a bit better with what people have been discussing so far, I'm going to talk about not coherent magnetism in 1D, but something related to incoherent magnetism in 1D. And this is recent work with Leon. I'm Greg Feet. I'm sorry? Write it down? Okay. Okay. Okay, yeah, so for the record. Yeah, so let's see if I can spell. Okay. Okay, so hopefully this is right. Okay, there is a preprint available on this, and this is the preprint number. And what I want to talk about is a calculation of the Green's function of electrons in 1D in a particular limit which is often not considered, and that's where the exchange energy between electrons is much less than temperature, which is in turn much less than the Fermi energy. So in order to reach this limit, one basically needs to look at low electron densities, because otherwise the exchange energies are typically of the order of Fermi energy. So what we're interested in is the average density of electrons really going to zero, where the potential energy begins to dominate the kinetic energy. And two electrons have a difficult time exchanging positions because the tails of their wave functions have very small overlap. So what I'll do, I guess, to begin is write down the result, because it is fairly interesting in terms of its structure, and then I'll try to give the derivation, which is actually quite simple, and then I'll give some background on other ways to calculate this. So the quantity that we're really interested in is this Green's function.
So this is like a lattice or something?
No, this is not in a lattice. This is continuous.
So because nominally I have thought as density is going to zero, exchange will be larger than kinetic energy, right? I'm missing something. One goes as one over RS, one goes as one over RS squared, right?
Oh, I mean, so what you can yeah, so this, so if it's very dilute, then you can imagine that if you have electrons in some distance, so if potential energy is dominating, the electrons would like to avoid each other irrespective of their spin. So the electron density will look something like this.
Yes. Yeah,
so if you want to exchange
so
two electrons.
It's kind of 1 year limit, so that's what I was asking. You were thinking, so these are not free electrons.
Okay, well.
So it is kind of, okay, fine.
A lattice is not needed here, but you can think of it in terms of that, yeah,
these
conceptually.
Are some kind of one larger.
Yeah.
The lattice could be self generative somehow. You don't need a background lattice, but you are clearly thinking of electrons which are.
Yeah, we're going to imagine that the electrons are actually peaked about some average. Yeah, the wave functions peaked about an average position. I mean, this is a good picture to have in mind, actually. Right, so this is the quantity that we want to calculate. So we inject an electron at some position x and some imaginary time tau equal to zero, and then we remove it at some later time, imaginary time tau, and position x. And I want to initially consider the case where both x and tau are quite large, and we're going to look at the long-range asymptotics of this Green's function. And what one finds is interesting behavior. So there's a deviation from the usual sort of Schrödinger liquid paradigm of pure power law correlations, and here there's actually an exponential decay piece which is out front, and then you have familiar terms. There's a charge velocity that enters imaginary time, and there's an exponent here, delta g. I'll write that out in a minute. And then there are basically right and left moving parts of the Green's function. Okay, so this is the Green's function, and I'll describe what each of these terms are. So this kf twiddle here is not the usual kf. It's the kf for spinless electrons. So it's pi times the average density of the electrons. The next thing going out is these phis. I guess, well, the specific form is a little bit ugly, so I won't write it down, but it's basically a phase factor which depends on the charge velocity, the imaginary time tau position x, and also this parameter g in the charge sector of the Schrödinger liquid theory. So I will write out that exponent because that's a bit unusual. And in particular, one sees that these various factors of log 2 over pi are appearing. I don't know, can everyone see this in the shadow there?
Nope.
Okay. I don't know how to raise this thing. Okay. So maybe, yeah. So, oh, great, thank you. Much better. Yeah, so there's this unusual exponent here, and one way that you can see that it's somewhat unusual is if you take...
Squiggly thing before the 2, that log 2?
This is log 2, yeah.
This is a log 2 in the kf little...
And this is a log 2, yeah, so this is log 2 over pi. So there are these very strange factors that appear here. So the main thing I want to point out about this is that it's not a pure power law decay. There's an exponential piece. And also, there is no temperature appearing here. And just to avoid that question, what we've really done in calculating this Green's function is taken two limits. So first, we've taken a limit of j going to 0. And having taken that limit, the temperature is then taken to 0. So that's why temperature is not appearing in the final expression.
And x is positive here?
Yeah, so x is positive.
For x negative, is there an absolute value of x?
Yeah, there's an absolute value of x up here for x negative. Yeah, so it's always decaying with distance.
It's decaying.
Yeah, so it decays. So basically, there's some sort of incoherence in the spin degrees of freedom, which come from this limit here, which give rise to this exponential decay. So this is the result, and before I discuss how to obtain that in a fairly straightforward way, I just want to give one more piece, and that's you can calculate separately what is the Green's function at the same point in imaginary time. What you find is that it's tau to the 1 over 2g square root times log tau. And this is useful because you can Fourier transform that and get the energy dependence of the tunneling density of states, and you get a somewhat unusual form. So it looks similar to the usual Luttinger liquid behavior where there's some power law dependence to the tunneling density of states, but you'll notice that this 1 over 4g minus 1 is actually less than 0, provided g is greater than 1/4. So there's not a power law suppression in the tunneling density of states, but there's power law divergence in the tunneling density of states. And of course, this is valid for omega greater than temperature only.
So do you understand, so you cannot,
So you can't get this result from this result.
It's not.
Because the...
I mean, if I take x to 0, then...
Yeah, so this is not valid. So the you can't just put x to 0 in this and get that result.
So there is some condition on x.
Yeah. I mean, basically, that's why I wanted to emphasize that x is positive here and going to infinity.
Since that you say x has to be greater than 1 over here.
Yeah. Basically, that's the condition. So in order to get this, basically, we need to sort of lose the discreteness of the electrons in this picture and allow for sort of continuous distortions. So this is really sort of a long wavelength picture that's needed to get this. And here actually, we're going to rely on some discreteness in a sense of, well, that's what I'll come to next, the world lines of these electrons and what they look like.
So this diverging can be viewed as coming from the heavily degenerate spin derivative.
Yeah.
Sort of like left over in this beautiful form.
Yeah.
If you take j equals 0, you got basically lots of delta function there, and somehow it turned out finite j, but not too large, then you sort of have this.
Yeah, that's exactly the interpretation, right? That there's a huge spin degeneracy at low energies, and that's what gives the divergence in this. And it competes with the power law suppression from the charge sector. Mm-hmm. And so if you turn up the interactions in the charge sector and bring this Luttinger parameter g to be less than 1/4, then it goes over to the power law. Okay.
I always said this, but what was phi?
So phi, these are phases. Okay. They're real quantities, and the expression for them is somewhat long, and since time is short, I'll leave them out, but I can show them to you if you want. Okay, so as background to this, it's important to mention a few other papers, and something quite similar to this was calculated recently, and there's a nice paper by Chayanov and Zvonarev, And that's PRL of this year. So this is the announcement of their result, which basically is an alternative calculation to ours for the special case of g equals to 1/2. Maybe I'll write it up here. So g equals to 1/2, and they did everything on the lattice with the Hubbard model. So they took the u equals infinity limit of the Hubbard model and calculated the Green's function using some Fredholm determinant beta ansatz based calculation. This is the announcement of their calculation. Their 40-page calculation is contained in this paper, Journal of Physics A, Math, volume 37. And that was also published. So it's not going to take us 40 pages of beta ansatz to calculate this Green's function. And we're also able to get it for general g, not just g equals to 1/2.
They have the result for all distances, not just large distances?
They have it for large distances and small distances, and they have separate expressions for each. So they don't have a continuous function which interpolates between them.
Yeah. And it wasn't actually Schmelzer who did that, right? Some Russian guy about 5 years ago made a special trip to Princeton to show me this stuff because it was a counter stuff to the.
Yeah, I looked up Schmelzer's papers and I didn't find it. Okay.
Schmelzer was also coming up to Princeton to show stuff, but it was somebody, I think it was a guy who might have been in Madrid or something like that. I can't remember. Someone said the name. I don't think it was either of those two Russian names.
Okay. So, yeah. Okay, but in any case, it's certainly a current problem, and this is a PRL from this year. So what I would like to do then is basically sketch the calculation of this, and it turns out that it's quite intuitive, and there's a nice physical picture of where these various pieces of the Green's function come from. So let me erase, I guess, this reference and see if I can put the whole calculation on the right-hand side of the board here. Okay, so what one wants to do is express the Green's function. Well, formally, it's just the trace of e to the minus beta h times these electron creation and annihilation operators.
Can you write down precisely what h is?
So h is nothing precise. We're going to use an effective low energy theory. Okay. So we're going to use a low energy version of h. So I want to leave it unspecified.
It's universal.
Yeah.
So let me write down your favorite name.
Take your Hubbard model.
Yeah. So.
That's right. So.
Okay.
So that's precisely.
That's exactly what they got.
They just took the infinite u Hubbard model.
Yeah.
With at half filling or something. Or
any filling. No, not half filling. I mean, okay. It's a metal. So.
Okay. Okay.
So yeah, the only thing
could be for infinite U extended Hubbard model, BW, whatever.
I just want one. Okay.
Sorry. Give me an infinite set.
Okay. No. One. One H. Okay.
Yeah.
You will get it on
the G's, right?
But the only thing that we're going to rely on in the low energy theory is spin independent interactions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just. Okay. So H just depends on psi. There's no other fields involved.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so this is the object that we want to calculate. And really, Leon had the very clever suggestion for calculating this. And it's to think about this object, this Green's function, in terms of a first quantized path integral picture, where these electrons can be represented as world lines. So, and that actually can take you a long way. Okay, so. Let's first consider the calculation of the partition function z. So what happens in the imaginary time representation is that if we consider an electron's location, then it wanders through someplace, and at the end of the day, it has to end up at the same position at tau equals to beta as it was at tau equals to zero for periodic boundary conditions. And there are various trajectories that the electrons can take, and there are spin indices associated with these trajectories. And each contribution to Z, the partition function, has some term which is of this form. There's a minus 1 raised to a permutation index for the number of permutations of up and down electrons. We must always have an up electron come to an up electron and down electron come to a down electron, satisfy the boundary conditions, periodic boundary conditions. And then these permutations have some weight associated with them, which comes from basically the distortion of this this sort of elastic lattice of world lines. So there's an action cost, for example, of bringing two electrons very close together, and that's reflected in this. So each contribution to Z for a specific world line configuration will have something like this. There are permutation factors out front, and there is some action associated with basically the energy, kinetic and repulsive energy of these electrons. Okay, so if we consider the numerator, then there are similar things involved, only now we have injected an electron at some point, the origin here, and we've removed it at another point. So basically, there's going to be some sort of world line in the numerator, which is going to look something like this. Okay, so now we want to think about spin. And what we want to do in the end is convert the world line picture into a totally spinless problem. I mean, that's physically plausible. As soon as the density gets very low, then these electrons like to stay away from each other regardless of their spin orientation, and the low energy theory in this limit should reflect that. So if we actually focus on this condition now, and we ask, okay, so what does J much less than T mean? So it means that the energy is very large compared to the characteristic spin energies.
So the spins are gapped?
Well, I mean, in principle, they're gapped, but they may be gapped. But if the temperature is much larger than J, then all spin configurations are degenerate. So we're going to make use of the fact that all spin configurations are degenerate when we evaluate this trace. But before I do that, I want to invert that expression and say, well, let's consider the reciprocal of it. So that means that 1 over J is much bigger than beta. And since this is something like the typical rate of particle exchange, then what it means is that basically electrons of opposite spin are not allowed to exchange each other in this picture. I mean, there's just not enough room in imaginary time to do it. So what we're going to use is a non-crossing approximation in these world lines. So we're saying that electrons are not allowed to exchange their spin. Okay, so this is really sort of the key computational point. There's a non-crossing approximation. Okay, so now that we have a non-crossing approximation, we can compute the trace over the spin degrees of freedom. So what we want to do is inject an electron at some point. Let me not take the origin, but just for purposes of the picture, take some other point and something like this. So the world lines of these electrons are going to distort in some way when that electron is added and then removed. And what we want to do is recall that we're interested in a very large x. So we want to inject an electron at some point and remove it at some very far away point out here. Okay, so there's some mean density of the electrons, and we have x much bigger than the typical separation between those. So what we want to do really is inject an electron here, take it a far distance away. But according to our non-crossing approximation, that would mean that these other particles need to bend around in some way for arbitrary spin orientations. Okay, but this obviously cost a lot of energy in the action. So this is not the sort of path that is going to dominate the contributions from the charge sector. because it's going to cost a lot of action, so those will be exponentially suppressed. So instead, what's going to happen is that the electron is going to make use of the periodic boundary conditions in imaginary time and essentially wrap around the imaginary time torus. So I'll draw it dotted. So the sort of trajectory it will follow is something rather like this. So I inject it here. So this point here is meant to be the same as this point. This point is meant to be the same as this point. So the particle is allowed to wrap around the torus, provided that the spin of this electron is exactly the same as the spin of this electron. So when it wraps around, then it can have periodic boundary conditions satisfied. Okay. So this is the key point here, that in order to look at the long-range correlation function, the processes that contribute to this are these sort of processes, where the electron wraps around an imaginary time. Okay, so once you have that, then essentially the calculation is done, because you realize there's a constraint on the spin indices of all intermediate lines. They must be the same as the spin of the injected electron. Okay, so when the trace is taken, that means the only term that survives of all the spin configurations that can be in between these two is the one term where all spins have the same orientation. Okay, so the probability, if there are n intermediate lines of that, that's just 1 over 2 to the n plus 1 of all these spin configurations having the same spin. Okay, so now the mathematics comes in. So this is all the physics. So we used a non-crossing approximation to say that these lines aren't crossing, and then we used an energy argument saying that we want to stay in the low energy sector. This costs a lot of action. This doesn't. But if we take this path, we have a constraint on the spins. So now we actually want to use that information to calculate a Green's function. Yeah.
He's got something. When you have this the world line wrapping around,
yeah,
doesn't that say that I have, you know, more electrons if I take a cut through?
Well, there's always the right number of electrons. So if you take a cut, say here, then suppose you wanted to wrap this way, then any line which was here would have to be bent around that way. So if you take any cut like this, it'll pass the same number of lines at any tau. So you haven't created any additional electrons. Yeah.
I have a similar question. Is the non-crossing approximation somehow equivalent to taking J0?
Yes.
Is that J very small?
Yes, it is. It is, in fact, taking J equals to 0. So it says you precisely never cross.
But
and that's this limit here. So I'm saying that I'm taking J to 0.
Okay, so that limit can be taken already at this stage, you're saying. Well, I guess I'm trying to see the math and not know what
it is. Well, it is being taken at this stage, essentially. Essentially, this comment is taking the J to 0 limit. But I have not yet taken temperature to 0.
I understand. So it's really...
Okay, so now, in order to do calculations, we have to have some theory. So to answer your question about the Hamiltonian, essentially, all we're going to assume now is that the interactions are just depend on the density. So the interactions just depend on the particle density. And there's an effective low energy theory in the charge sector, which is basically the same that you would get from a Luttinger liquid theory. So I'll just write down the action. Some charge velocity. And then there are the usual theta and phi fields. Okay, so you might notice that there's a different factor of 2 that's floating around than you might be used to, and that comes from the definition that we've used. So we've said that theta is equal to the sum of the spin up and spin down fields instead of the square root multiplying that. And that's because basically at this stage we've reduced the problem to spinless problem. So the spin constraint is going to give us some factors, but otherwise, this is essentially the topology of spinless particle world lines. And as usual, the density fluctuations are related to the density in this way. So what we can do is bosonize the problem in the usual way by making the following association. Okay, so plus minus, plus minus. And so this is a theory. So this is the action for the charge sector. And now what we want to do is use this to compute the remaining correlation that survives after the Green's function. So after this is spin averaged, then what we have left for the Green's function is actually just the following. And then this is actually pretty close to the end. Okay, so in the end, what you get is you get what's that?
We need to wrap up.
Oh, we need to wrap up now? Okay, so this is the last expression. So there's a piece coming from the spin average, a piece coming from Fermi statistics, and then there's the usual piece associated with creating the electron and removing it. And it turns out that if you relate n to the total density here and then express it in terms of the theta fields, and you just simply calculate away these correlators using this Lagrangian, then you get that. So maybe I'll just leave it there. So this is all the physics. From there, it's just a matter of doing calculations. And this is something a little bit different, but I don't have time to discuss it. But it's actually quite a trivial generalization. I'll be happy to for anyone who wants to ask me about it.
Where does the exponential come from?
So the exponential here is actually one more equation I'll write. That's equal to this n bar x plus 1 over pi theta of x minus theta of 0. And so when you plug this expression in here, then that x piece exponentiated gives you this. And the log 2 comes from an exponentiating 2. And the pi there is because of kf, and n is related in this way. OK, thank you.